I thought that vulnerability, you know, was for the birds. Like, I thought that was for weak people. And, you know, what I learned is that vulnerability is strength. Like, I'm much stronger now that I was able to be vulnerable and that I am able to be vulnerable.
From Headspace Studios, this is The Gift of Forgiveness. I'm Katherine Schwarzenegger Pratt. On this show, we're telling people's stories as truthfully as possible. Sometimes you might feel uncomfortable or anxious. If that happens, I encourage you to pause and take some deep breaths. Today, my guest is my friend, Chelsea Handler. She's a comedian, activist, New York Times bestselling author, talk show host, and the host of her own podcast. I knew that I had to have her on this show because she's such an open person, and I especially wanted to talk to her after reading her most recent book, Life Will Be the Death of Me. In it, she writes about the anger she's dealt with and her process of ridding herself from it. She also writes openly about her struggle to forgive her brother after a fatal accident that left her feeling abandoned. Abandonment is one of the worst feelings in the world, especially when we feel it as a child. And for Chelsea, it was a big part of her identity for a long time. She told herself she was perfectly fine. She never needed help from anyone. She says she just bulldozed her way through her career. But that kind of thinking usually comes crashing down. You'll hear Chelsea refer to her therapist, Dan, a few times in this episode. Full disclosure here, I saw Dan for therapy several years ago, and since then have gotten to know him as a friend. You'll hear more from Dr. Dan Siegel on a later episode of this series where we talk about forgiveness and understanding the psychological reasons it can be so challenging for many of us. We talk about family dynamics, forgiving your siblings and parents, and if anything is truly unforgivable.
Hi.
Hi, guys.
Hi, how are you?
Katherine, pull yourself together.
I'm sorry, but
she's always giggling.
I was just telling... I know it's a problem. This is something that we've already established. It's very, it's concerning, but you know, apparently I need to go back to Dan Siegel to have that worked out. But I learned that very well in your book.
Everybody has to go back to Dan Siegel.
I know. When I was reading your book and I listened to it on Audible, which I'm actually so happy that I did because I could just get a totally different experience of you and your book, even though I know you, just it was very different. I was telling my mom about that. But every single time you talked about Dan, I knew exactly what he was doing, what facial expressions, the leaning forward, the sympathy, the asking you further questions. It was like I was having flashbacks of my whole experience in there.
It's so funny you say that because it's like the year of like therapy books in our community. Like there was another book, I Think You Need to Talk to Somebody, by Lori Gottlieb. And I was like, my friends go to that therapist who was in that book. And she's like,
really?
And they're all in the same therapy community, you know, because they're like, it's just such a small world in this town. But yeah, it was so funny. And she's like, all these therapists are being outed this year.
I was actually wondering, like, when you, I know that Dan was on your show, but I was also wondering, like, how he, if he was like totally fine with that whole thing, because he's become such a well-known person from you talking about him as well.
Well, yeah, I think he was well-known before, you know,
in a very specific community, I feel like he was well-known, you know, like now people who are in a totally different world know about him because he's well-known for his books and his teachings and, you know, in a variety of different communities, but also I'm sure you talking about him brought him into a whole other different world.
Yeah, I'm sure one he was dying to delve into. but yeah, he was pretty, I mean, he knew that I was coming from a pretty earnest place with the book because I was like, listen, I want to write about this experience because I felt like if he was changing me in that way, somebody who was really stuck and really intransigent and not willing to like admit it, like I was fine, I didn't need help, blah, 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 like those defenses up. If he could get to me, like, I felt like, oh my God, this could be helpful to so many people. Like, if I'm experiencing this, who isn't? And and so when he saw it was coming from that kind of, you know, perspective and that I was wanting to share in, I've overshared my entire career. So it was nice to overshare something that was, you know, nice instead of just being loud for no reason, you know, it was like, hey, this can help you maybe.
Yeah.
So that was, yeah. So it was kind of a no-brainer. He and I have done a couple of events together since. We're quite the like traveling circus act. You know, he talks seriously about therapy and I roll my eyes and, you know, people seem to like it. So who knows?
No, it's amazing. It's actually, it reminded me, especially of when you first talked about in your book about going to him for the first time. It reminded me a lot of how I felt going to therapy for the first time with him, of just, you know, thinking that therapy was crazy and just like, you know, something that, that you use these, you know, words similar. I know you hate the word journey, but just, you know, these, kind of fluffy words to describe something. And I just thought that I was very angry when I first walked in that door. And so I, to have somebody so calmly speak to me for some reason irritated me even more.
Yeah, totally.
And I remember leaving the first time and I was like, I am more rageful than when I walked in that door. And how is this supposed to be helpful? But then you have to, you know, obviously give it time. But yeah, I just, to also to hear you read your book, I mean, your book is amazing. And I heard that a million times over from my mother, who, as you know, is a huge fan of yours and told me that you check in on her once a week through quarantine, which is so nice. But when I was listening to the audio version of it, I called my mom after I finished it. And I was saying to her that, that, you know, I have known you for several years, but also you know this kind of TV version of yourself, and you talk about this in the book, and to read it and have this emotional side come out of you, especially when you're talking about your brother, made me not only so emotional, but also understand you in a totally different way that I always knew was there, but it was just a different, I don't know if I would have gotten it in the same way reading it as I did listening to you. And the way that you also narrated your book made me feel terrible about how I narrated my book. Truly. I was like, she's so good at this. I am so bad at this.
Oh, please. I've done so many books where I've been so bad at it. This was like the first time that I've recorded, like, I hate audiobooks, like recording that part. And I once pawned it off. I had had them hire like a sound alike and it was not received well. Like people were not into that. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, because it's such a pain in the ass, you know, like I'm used to performing with my face, not just my voice. So it's hard to like,
but it was so good.
Thank you. This one kind of was a different experience. I was relaxed and I went into it and I was completely like present and connected with obviously the material because it was so raw that it worked. And then I was like, oh, see, if you didn't have to complain all these years about doing this. If you're just focused and present, you can get it done in 2 days, but instead of it taking 3 weeks, like an ag, I go in on an hour on Tuesday and after an hour, I'd be like, can I come back tomorrow? I'm over it.
But also yours was, I'm sure, so that for this book, probably really emotionally exhausting to have to reread and also speak the entire book.
I think though, like, you know, once, like if you're someone like me and all of a sudden you get in touch with your actual feelings and emotions and you sit with that instead of, you know, running from it, which is what I did, you like sit with the uncomfortableness and the unknown and the feelings. It's like you're getting it out of your system for once and for all. So it's worth the kind of fight, you know, because then you can kind of just like expunge all, not expunge, what's the word I'm thinking of?
Expel.
Yeah, that's a good one. Use that. Expel it all out of you instead of it kind of rearing its head throughout your life. Every time you're, you know, go through a difficult experience, you have all your childhood stuff come back up. It's like if you sit with it finally and you're real, you can get rid of it and then you move on, you know? And that's what I was interested in. I was like, what, how do I get to the next place?
I see it with like a lot of people that are my age, but also a lot of people who are older than me, of just wondering if anybody will ever get to a place of wanting to have that desire of going back and figuring out like how childhood affects your life, or like just continuing to live life, not wanting to go into the emotional stuff or the, you know, the detail.
I think some people don't want to deal with that. You know, they don't want the emotion. They don't want to go to therapy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's too real and too raw. I know a lot of people, I feel like, will never get there, but also, do you think you would have even gotten there if you didn't have the Trump election to experience?
I don't know about that. I mean, I think I probably would have hit a wall sometime because I was getting really not present. Like everything was a blur. You know, I was like, I didn't want to be at work. I didn't want to be anywhere. I was just like, everything was kind of a burden. And my attitude was getting really sucky. And I was like, that was something I wasn't going to tolerate. Like I wasn't going to be cashing checks when I was having a shitty personality or, you know, like behaving not in my best way. So I just kind of was, the Trump election for sure, like set me over because then I had something to be mad about. You know, then I was like, oh, I could pin it all on Trump. This is why I don't like the unjustness of this. And that was just another, you know, way to like be angry at something. So I didn't look like I was crazy. Like I had an object or subject to be pissed about. But in reality, it's like, no, it's not Trump. You know, Trump is a problem, of course, but that's not the where my anger is from.
And now is that like a forgivable situation for you or is that something that's not going to happen?
Yeah, I think we're past the point of forgiveness for this administration. but what it has, you know, brought up in a lot of people and lit up in a lot of people is their compassion and empathy. It's made a lot of us pay more attention to the world, you know what I mean? And how we can contribute in a more meaningful way. I know it certainly has had that impact on me, seeing, you know, one example after another of the mistreatment of whether it be immigrants or American citizens at this point. I think it brings out either the best in you or the worst in you, you know? So I definitely am, you know, contemplative more about the contributions I'm making in terms of like creative endeavors and what I do and what I'm putting out there and trying to be mindful of that and not just trying to get myself to the next point of success. You know what I mean? Let that not be my motivating factor.
Do you feel like there are any specific examples in your past where you have struggled with forgiveness, come out the other side, or had forgiveness life lessons in your experience?
I mean, I get the most prominent one would be, you know, just forgiveness of my dad and Chet and, you know, the reaction to my brother dying.
Maybe we could just talk a little bit about your relationship with your brother and, you know, the leaving you kind of feeling this sense of, would you say, anger toward him for not coming back?
Yeah. So I grew up with six of us and I was the youngest and he was the oldest. So we were like, I say in the book, we were like bookends, you know, because he was like the captain and I was like the mascot of our family. And he took me everywhere with him. And my parents were, they're not hippy dippies because that's too cool a term for what my parents were. They were just more disorganized and over it. Like my mom is the opposite of your mom. That's why I love your mom so much because she seems like a mom, you know, like she's maternal. like she's in your business, she's up your butt, you know, like I like that. I like that meddlesome mom because I never had that. but my mom was just like, they were just tired. And it was very clear when I was born that like I was on my own and my brothers and sisters were more my like parental figures. You know, my dad laid down the law and my mom just kind of, you know, wasn't interested in showing up at school events or, you know, any of that stuff. So we were like, a kind of a little bit of a baseball team. Like we just kind of all did our own thing. We were all against our parents together. Like we always had a plan who was going to get the pizza, who was going to ask for Chinese food, you know, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And who was the favorite, blah, blah, blah. But my brother, he was going on a hiking trip to the Grand Tetons. And I remember the night before he left, he had come home from work and he had ran up the stairs. And we'd play this game and I'd be lying in my mom's bed and I'd cover myself up. I was like 8 years old. And he'd be like, where is she? Where is she? And my mom would be like, she's not here. And I'd be like, shut up, mom. You're not even in this game, you know? And my brother would like find my feet under the covers and just tear me out of the bed, flip me over his shoulders. And we'd run downstairs while he was tickling me. And I'd act like I was, you know, scared and wanted to get away. Meanwhile, there was no place I would have rather been. And he brought me downstairs and I would make him cereal when he got home from work. Like he had just graduated college and he was working at this place called Motor Clip for our next door neighbors. And I was like making him his dinner. Like, you know, we were a couple talking about our day. And I remember him saying, I'm going on this hiking trip. And I was like, you know, don't go. Like, that's not cool. I don't want to drive to Martha's Vineyard with mom and dad. I want to be with you. And he looked at me and he was like, I promise you, I will never, ever leave you with these people. And he was talking about my parents, of course. Mm-hmm. And then he left and went hiking and had an accident and fell off a cliff and died. And I didn't know until I met Dan and I was ready to discuss that, because I thought that was something like, oh, you know, that happens to lots of families, whatever, it's no big deal. I didn't want to discuss it. I didn't understand that, you know, in many ways I was stuck as that 9-year-old girl. Like, my emotions mm-hmm. stopped growing because he had deserted me. So even though intellectually I understood it was an accident, a 9-year-old girl, 8-year-old girl takes that as rejection. Somebody saying, I'm coming back, I'll never leave you, and then they're gone. That's a lie, so you can't trust him. And then my father fell apart after that. I couldn't trust him. So the two main men in my life proved themselves to be unreliable. So I had no modeling for a healthy relationship with a man, which explains my situation.
And why my mother is in charge of it.
Exactly. Desperate times.
We're going to take a quick break, but before we do, this series is produced by Headspace Studios. Headspace has thousands of hours of meditation, mindfulness, movement, and sleep content. The best tool you have is your mind, so take care of it. Learn more at headspace.com. I'm talking with Chelsea Handler. When Chelsea was young, her brother died in a tragic hiking accident. She didn't know how to go about forgiving someone who wasn't there to forgive.
And I loved the way that you talked about your brother and losing your brother as your relationship with him as being like your first crush and the first time you had your heart broken. I'm sure Dan has voiced to you, because he has taught me a lot about just, you know, birth order and sibling dynamics and how each one is so unique. But really going back to, you know, losing your brother as, of course, having this feeling of, you know, disappointment and like you couldn't trust him because he actually didn't do what he promised. But also, like, this was the first time that you had a crush on your, not in a weird way, but like your first crush had broken your heart.
Yeah, that's something Dan taught me about, which I'm sure you know about, as attachment figures, you know, and discovering that, oh, the reason I was affected in this way is because, you know, Chet was an attachment figure to me, more so than probably my own father, you know, and so that was a discovery. It's like, oh, these are the relationships that you are bound, like you're tied to this person. I have it with my sister for sure, and I had it with my mom, but, you know, Dan pointed out, you don't have it with your father. And I was like, oh, I didn't like hearing that, you know? Yeah. And you don't want to blame your parents. You make excuses for them all the time. Like, I would tell them they did the best that they could, or I would tell them a story about them not picking me up from Hebrew school, just completely forgetting me and like being stuck in the parking lot with the Hebrew school janitor. And Dan would be like, you were neglected. I'm like, well, Dan, no, they did that to all my brothers and sisters. They didn't pick anyone up. And he'd be like, but you were all neglected. And I'd be like, no, it wasn't like that. We were like loved. And he's like, you don't have to apologize for your parents. You just have to accept that that's the best that they could do. And yeah, it wasn't great. I was neglected. I didn't want to admit that I had been neglected.
Whenever you're in therapy and therapists point out, my mom also has a way of doing it. And I remember the first time that she did it to me when I was in high school and I broke up with my first boyfriend. She was like, you were hurt. You were hurt. And I was just like, absolutely not. That is not what happened. Like, it's this part of us that just wants to immediately defend and disagree with Yeah, exactly.
Ball yourself up in your own mm-hmm. protective gear. And you're like, you think you're doing a good job. It's like every time you do that, you're adding like a longer period of time till you like wake up.
What was the anger like with your brother? I know that you dealt a lot with that, obviously, with Dan, but just, you know, because I think the anger, especially with somebody who's no longer on this earth for you to talk to, was there a forgiveness journey that you had to go through in regards to your brother?
It was more about forgiving myself. You know what I mean? Like, it was more about having compassion for that little girl part of me that I wasn't ever taking seriously or serious enough. It was about acknowledging that I was stuck, that I had a lot of pain, and that now I'm a grown up and I can actually have compassion for that little girl. Instead of trying to protect her, I can actually think about those feelings and reassure her and say, hey, it's not like that anymore. We're 45 now. Like, I'm here now. It was more about self-forgiveness. And again, you know, as this comes up with any conversation about this subject matter, you're really good at forgiving people when you forgive yourself.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think most people talk about self-forgiveness as being the most challenging form of forgiveness because it requires such honesty and also hard work of looking at yourself and your own wounds and pain, and looking at that head on is oftentimes more painful than looking at, you know, what another person did or another person's mess ups.
Right. And then there's that period of self-awareness, like you mm-hmm. become self-aware. So your therapist hopefully helps you discover, okay, so you're like, oh, wow, I'm like, in my case, I'm like, oh, I'm a real bitch. Like, no wonder people are scared of me. Like I thought, you know, and all the self-awareness piles on and you're like hyper self-aware. And then you become hyper self-vigilant. And like every interaction, I'm like, okay, you have this adjustment that you need to make now, you know, and in many cases you can overcorrect and you're like, mm-hmm. you become a different person. And you're like, wait a second, that's not me either. But there's a period after where you become self-aware that's really haunting too, because you're like, well, who am I now? And how do I behave? I want to be kinder and gentler, but I don't want to lose my edge. I want to be funny and say, you know, inappropriate things too. Like, I want that to be all of me. So there is a period where you kind of like, you know, you get to know this like more mature or adult person version of yourself, and you have to blend it with the older version of yourself.
We don't think about that as we get older, that that's something that is a super crucial part of our development as adults, is to go back to that age of whenever we experienced a trauma and talk to that young version of ourselves and heal that young version of ourselves is still such a fascinating thing to me. Before you went to see Dan, did you have a relationship at all with forgiveness in your life?
Not a good one. I mean, I would write people off left and right if somebody did something that I thought was unacceptable. It wasn't like, oh, you can give them another chance. It was like, that was their chance and there's no coming back. Like, I had no gray. It was all black and white. And, mm-hmm. you know, you burn a lot of bridges that way, but you also, people are, it's so unkind to other people to do that, to not give them a chance and to shut them out. So I didn't have a good relationship with forgiveness. I thought that my morals were so important. You know what I mean? Like, no, mm-hmm. I won't stand for this. And it's like, shut up. Like, you know, you can be like that without screaming about it. And that was my, you know, that was my big takeaway from Dan. It's like, how do I continue to be myself without screaming? I've cultivated a bit of empathy. So I'm a little bit more in touch in that regard with forgiveness. Is that you really have to empathize with what another person's story has been. Like for my father, I was in such harsh judgment of him for so many years because he wasn't what I wanted him to be, but I didn't take into account, you know, his history or his childhood or his birth order and what happened to him growing up and him, what it was like for him to lose his firstborn son, you know, what that meant to him. I wasn't you know, empathizing with people enough. And without empathy, it's hard to forgive other people because you have to, I was assuming everybody came from where I was coming from. which is not only narcissistic, but delusional. So it opened my brain to actually think about where somebody's coming from, think about their family, their circumstances, you know, their job, their stresses, and know that they're different than yours.
Was that a forgiveness journey with your dad that you addressed at all while he was still alive? Or was that a lot of the work that you did with Dan after he had passed?
Yeah. That was after. I didn't have any, you know, we didn't have any revelatory conversations when he was alive. I just got pretty, I mean, we had honest conversations, but only always when you're in the middle of a fight or something. It's not like we ever sat down and said, "Hey dad, like, listen," no, I didn't get that closure until after my dad died. And partly from going to his funeral, because that ended up being like this beautiful day. And it was such a dreary day in New Jersey. And it ended up just being so sweet and kind of reminded me, you know, all the things I was just saying about my dad, that he was a human being too. And he had been through a lot. And, you know, he was a great dad in many ways. And many ways that it wasn't convenient for me to think about, you know, like I was remembering all the bad stuff and the times he forgot to pick me up at Heber School, or the times, you know, he would come to my softball games and scream on the sidelines wearing, like, you know, a sweater covered in dog hair and like snow boots. I was like, oh my God, get out of here. But I wasn't remembering, you know, all the great things he had done for me and all the times he was there for me and all the love that he had given me. So there was a lot of forgiveness after he passed away. I don't have a lot of guilt because I don't have a lot of regret about most things. I just kind of want to know more information to do better moving forward. I always say when I talk about meditation, I always picture my mom comes down. We're on the bay of Katama Bay, our summer house where I grew up and all my happy memories are from. And I'm like, my mom comes down. I feel my mom's present. I feel my brother, Chet, my cousin, Eddie, who passed away last year. He's always there. And my cousin goes, "Do you ever see our dads?" Because her dad and my dad both died last year. I'm like, "No." I'm like, "Are you sure you ever feel them?" I'm like, "They're not there yet. They're like in purgatory or something." I'm like, "Because they have more work to do."
That's amazing. I love that. I think it's such a nice thing to think about when you're envisioning that, this idea of like having, you know, your cousin or your mom come down and be in this like meditative state. Because I think when you're oftentimes told to not think about anything, that's, for me at least, super challenging. Are you meditating every single day?
I am.
You know, I myself have, as I mentioned earlier, went through a phase of like thinking that therapy was not for me, not for, you know, it was for weak people. And I know that you went through a similar feeling of that as well. And then obviously have now written a huge part of your book about how beneficial therapy has been for you and continues to be. What would you say to somebody who is in a similar situation of feeling like therapy is for the weak?
Well, that's exactly what I thought. And, you know, I thought that vulnerability, you know, was for the birds. Like, I thought that was for weak people. And, you know, what I learned from going to Dan is that vulnerability is strength. Like, I'm much stronger now that I was able to be vulnerable and that I am able to be vulnerable. Like, it's like opening a faucet, you know, I hadn't cried for so long. And then he kind of like opened me up. And then I was like, bleh, to anyone who would listen. I was like, my brother died, you know, to anyone. So I kind of like let it all out. And then I slowly became this kind of more self-actualized, more grounded person because of all of that vulnerability. So it is scary to go into it. It's not a pleasant experience to be driving to therapy knowing that you're probably going to cry and like fighting those tears in the first six sessions, which is what I did with Dan. Like, I'm like, I am not going to fucking cry. No way is he going to make me cry. You know, it was like this barricade. And then finally, once I let it loose, I was like, oh, this feels good. So I would encourage anybody who's on the fence, like, nobody goes to therapy and gets worse. Like, nobody's like, wow, that really, you could find a therapist you don't click with, but you're not going to stay with that person. And when they say, nobody ever says, oh, that therapist really, you know, threw me off course and my whole life fell apart. That's not what happens.
It is so true, but there are so many people I find who, even still, like, with the amount of awareness that we have about therapy, some people are still so set in their ways of like, oh, I tried a couple therapists and, you know, it didn't work for me. Therapy's not for me. And I just, like, to me, my reaction is always like, that's, you just didn't find the right person, because it is so much about, you know, the person who you vibe with and, you know, who you feel comfortable with, because sometimes, you know, people just are annoyed by each other, or they just do not mesh well. So I think it is 100% about finding a person that works for you. Do you feel like there are any parts of forgiveness in certain situations in your life that you still struggle with at all? Or is it, do you feel like empathy has just kind of fixed that or cured it and made it easier?
No, now I have an awareness about it. Now I know, if you're feeling this way, it's because of an injury from a long time ago, probably in middle school. Like, if I have something like, you know, if it's something that's brings up a disturbance, or like where I'm like, and I want to retreat, like, I always know, oh, look at yourself. Like, what are you doing? Is that an adult way to behave right now? Like, are you really upset about this? Or is this about something old? So now I have the awareness to identify it. And that's half the battle. It's like, oh, stop. Don't act on that. You're just having an old feeling. So that's what Dan has taught me a lot about, you know, being like, you're just being conscious and present.
Yeah. You're also incredibly self-aware, like to even be able to do that, or to have moments where you do, whether it's with forgiveness or just, you know, life in general, to be able to pause, like you were talking about in the book, but also now of just pausing and realizing like, oh, that might be an old wound that's coming up that's causing this reaction, is, I think, so helpful to be able to have that with someone, you know, who can be quick to react in certain situations, but also it's so hard to do in the moment, I have found personally, because it's like, to actually not react in the moment is a really challenging thing to do.
Yeah. I mean, it's always great to take a minute. Like, I had never even contemplated that before I met Dan, like not reacting to an email the minute I wouldn't even finish reading it. And I had already written a response. Like, it taking time to digest and waking up in the morning and going, do I even need to send any email at that point? You know, when it becomes less important, and to give yourself just a beat. My big thing was my impulsivity and my reactivity. And those were the two things that, being self-aware helps you not repeat the pattern. And the great thing about like getting into new habits and rehabituating yourself is that, you know, you do something for 3 days in a row and all of a sudden that's your new habit. So like the new habits are as easy to create as the old ones are to break. And we make such a big deal about that when it's simply just, you just put it in motion, you know?
Mm-hmm. When you were talking about self-forgiveness before and forgiving yourself when it comes to, you know, handling the death of your brother and learning about that and going back and working with Dan in therapy on healing that part of yourself, do you ever find that there are other parts of forgiving of yourself that you've had to do in your past or present?
I mean, I think I judge myself pretty harshly. So I try to like ease up on that. Like, I'm like, oh, you need to be there. You know, if I'm in the middle of a conversation and my mind wanders because I'm so aware of it, I'm like, whoa, what are you doing? You're not paying attention to this person. Your mind just went off. Like, I beat myself up about that. And that's what I was getting at is, when you become self-aware, it's like, that's a big pain in the ass too, because then you're like checking yourself all the time. And you're like, oh God, how can I be present when I'm like my own police officer now? So it's a whole roller coaster of things. But I find in my experience has been that everything's just a little phase, and some of it's kind of sucky and some of it's kind of great, but it always is just temporary. And then you get past it. You know, I'm not calling people back and like making amends for things that happened years ago. Like, it's not like, oh, I feel so terrible. It's just like, oh, I get that behavior now. I understand it. And I move forward, you know, without it. You know, like all I can do is be better now that I know better.
Yeah. And that's all because of what you've learned from Dan.
Yeah. Dan, Oprah, and Maya Angelou.
So lastly, would you say there's anything that you would consider in life to be unforgivable?
It depends. I guess with rehabilitation, like if somebody murdered somebody and they were in prison and felt sorry for that and found themselves, yeah, I think there's forgiveness in that. But for people like, you know, half the Republican Party and what they're doing to people that need government support more than ever in their lives and the way they're turning their backs on their people, that those people and their voters, I find that unforgivable. I think when you're putting people's lives and livelihood in danger, you know, death is supposed to mean something. It's supposed to matter. Like, that should be the last, that's it. Like, that's when we pay attention to prevent it from happening. So I think I find what Republican leaders pushing for, you know, their meat plant employees to go back to work when they know how rampant this virus is in that very city is unforgivable.
Yeah. So it's more for you, for unforgiveness on behalf of others.
Yes, pretty much. Yeah, you can't really. Yeah, because I'm so unflappable. You can't really do anything to me, as we've discussed.
I love that. Okay, well, thank you so much. It was so nice talking to you. I'm gonna get on my mother to just continue to.
Yeah, fight the good
push
fight.
Push firm. Fight the good fight. It's gonna happen. I know it.
Bye, Kat.
Bye. Thank you so much.
There are two lessons I took away from talking with Chelsea, both lessons in acknowledging our emotions. The pain of feeling abandoned after her brother's death is a kind of forgiveness process we don't often talk about. It can be taboo to talk about death as a betrayal, but sometimes it can really feel that way. And Chelsea had to acknowledge what she called that pain before she could find healing. The second lesson is that it's okay to be angry. In Chelsea's case, being angry and unforgiving with people, such as a political leader, can be productive. It can lead to accountability, action, and real change. Thanks for tuning in, and thank you to Chelsea Handler for sharing your forgiveness journey. The Headspace app has thousands of hours of mindfulness content for you, including meditations on forgiveness, grief, noting, and more. Download it today and try it for free. The Gift of Forgiveness is hosted and executive produced by me, Catherine Schwarzenegger Pratt. You can find my book, The Gift of Forgiveness, wherever books are sold. This show is produced by Monique Laborde, sound design by Dan Kroll. From Headspace Studios, the executive producers are Leah Sutherland, Morgan Selzer, and Sam Rogelet.